Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can all go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, our interesting customers pop in to rent something, and we go through the films that they've loved across their life. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop.
Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV?
Good morning.
Good morning, Russell.
Hey, Rusky.
How are you boys doing?
How are you doing, Russell? Especially
sure. Roller coaster of emotions.
Right?
welcome to the video store. Thank you for wandering into our lovely video store. We're at a very exciting, interesting point at this very moment. I got married this last weekend.
Woo!
Russell got married. Congrats, Russ. It was beautiful.
Thanks, man. Gaddy was there. Yeah. How are you, Gaddy?
I'm raw.
You're raw? Jesus. Yeah, that's not the adjective I was hoping for, but tired.
I'm elated and emotionally fulfilled, but physically broken.
Okay, lovely. It was an exciting weekend away in the bush. Gaddy, we're not recording with the video store. You make candy, the Gaddles Candy Company, and you and I are in the band Short Straw.
Mm-hmm.
Then we've got ourselves a Graham here today.
Hi.
Graham is an editor and also very much the producer of the show, and now an award-winning producer of the show. So we're going to get into that. Today is the guest episode. It's a sneaky little one we've managed to fit in. Between the marriage and quickly before I have to fly away to a honeymoon. And we wanted to quickly record this to announce the fact that we are so chuffed that we won some awards.
Yeah.
The South African Podcast Awards happened this last weekend.
During your wedding.
During
yeah,
my wedding.
Literally.
Yeah, so it was one of those things where I was very much wrapped up and involved in the excitement of the wedding, but did at a certain time check the messages or check the things, and it was so exciting to see that. And we were nominated in four categories.
That's right.
And I discovered that they actually didn't have like a winner and everyone else losers like in the Oscars.
They had like a tiered system.
Yeah, which I thought was very cool. It was like a sort of an Olympics, so to speak. So there was the announcement that we won gold in two of our categories and we were silver in the other two.
Yeah, I got them here if you want to go through
them. So yeah, we're going to get into it. Just a little background.
Yes.
So the South African Podcast Guild was formed many months ago, quite a while ago, and it was cool to join that. And it was exciting to then know that from that you qualified for the South African Podcast Awards. And it was just so lovely to get the announcement that we were finalists in as many as four categories. And and then it was cool to see the announcement of the winners, the gold and the silver. And it came moments before a speech at the wedding.
Oh, right.
So we'd had the father of the bride do a speech, and we'd had Leslie, this is my now wife, has a twin sister, gave a speech. And then just before it was my turn, we had our mains, and this is when this announcement came. And so my dad, who was the MC, was able to go, oh, and breaking news, by the way. I sort of didn't expect him to announce it to the whole wedding.
Yes.
I got a cheers for that.
Nice.
And then, of course, what was nice is Gad and Perrin were at the wedding, so we could have ourselves a little high five. unfortunately, Cole's away.
Yes.
And unfortunately, Graham, you couldn't make it, but we had ourselves a little celebration.
Yeah.
We need to put like a crest on the...
Like
they do in the films.
Yes. Yeah, well, also, if we were like a wine, this would be like a little sticker we could put on the bottle. So, big shout out to the Podcast Guild, the South African Podcast Guild. And they are doing this solely for their love.
Yes.
You know, this isn't a huge commercial sort of gain for them. And they've really brought this whole community together, which is really lovely and exciting. And it's very cool to be a part of. There's, you know, there are these community boards that... You know, these hundreds and hundreds of podcasters are in, where they're asking each other like all the questions I wish I could have asked a bunch of people. So it is lovely, and it's just doing so much good. And they did such a slick production, and they just kept it nice and simple and tight. And it was a great ceremony. So well done to those guys, and thank you. So yeah, we won for our genre category.
Yes.
Which was music and entertainment.
Music and entertainment. We got the gold.
Which is just lovely.
Right.
And then the other one we got the gold for was best production.
Best production quality.
Which really very much goes to you, Graham, because you are the producer of this. And you spend a lot of time, you know, making sure the quality of the show is great. So
yeah.
So if this can be our own little awards ceremony and our own little acceptance speech, thank you for all your time, Graham.
Yeah, of course,
We really appreciate it. This podcast couldn't exist without you.
No, yeah.
I don't listen to a lot of podcasts, and I listen to this one because
nice.
It sounds good.
Oh, that's good, Gad. Thank you. Thank you for your listen.
Yeah.
You fucking work here. No, but we appreciate you. Thank you, Gaddy.
It's definitely, it's like on par with international podcasts, and like that's not an easy thing to achieve.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Thanks, man. But yeah, the other one was best hosting and presenting, which we got a silver for.
We got a silver in that.
Which I think is lovely.
Yes.
And very grateful. And then the other one was
innovation and creativity.
Which is lovely.
Yeah, we got silver in that one as well.
Entirely sure what that means.
Yeah.
Just sort of concept-wise.
I guess so, yes.
Yeah, and I'm happy with that because right now, those listening to this, you are imagining your kind of video store.
Yes.
And you're imagining us.
Exactly.
And so if we've sort of created this world, even if it's just down to the door trinkle.
Exactly.
Hopefully that innovation is something for you.
Yeah. I think the sound of like a really good podcast, like I listened to some like podcasts where like you have to give your like your fantasy meal. And even though like I would never be interviewed, I'm like in my head, I'm still making up these things.
Yes.
And like you want people to be like, oh, what is my
what's
my sweetheart puppy
love?
Movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
No, and so, yeah, maybe we've helped people figure that kind of stuff out. Because
you can still tell us in the comments.
Yeah, let us know. We always love to hear that. We'd always love to get someone to just post anywhere on the Facebook group and on Instagram if you want to return something.
Yes.
You know, you can always just say, I'm returning, and just give us a movie that you've been watching. You can post this anytime, anywhere.
Exactly.
And that's what's lovely.
Yeah.
But yeah, today's guest is a chap called Stephen Adams.
That's right.
Who came into my life very briefly. Shout out to Mandla Dube, who is a very established, celebrated filmmaker here in South Africa and a special customer here at the video store. So we did a fantastic episode with him a couple of episodes back.
Yeah.
It was sort of earlier this year. Mm-hmm. He was in town. This guy, Stephen Adams, is a LA Hollywood-based, very much a big part of the film industry. He is what you would call a manager producer. And so I never knew him before, and I took this great opportunity to talk to him about, you know, his career. And I think this forms part of a series of guest chats that we've been having here at the video store, where we want to show you guys the nuanced jobs that exist in the film industry.
Yeah, exactly.
It took a previous episode with the guest Denham Richards to point out that the film industry is amazing. It employs everyone.
Yeah.
From lawyers to horse wranglers to chefs to, you know, costumes to any industry you can imagine is involved in the film industry, and that's what's so exciting. It's the army that we speak of that you need to make this art.
Yeah.
And in amongst that is this manager producer. So perhaps Graham, what are your thoughts on what this kind of job is or could be?
So from my understanding, it's not one you hear about like almost ever. I think that when he started talking about it, it was the first time I've ever really thought about what this term means.
Mm.
The way he explains it, basically, he'll obviously go into more detail, but he talks about essentially, he is the guy who he represents a company, for example. Like in his case, he's a visual effects producer quite often, and he works with a French visual effects house called Boeuf, which is a very, very old visual effects house. They've been in the industry forever.
Yeah,
and he's the guy who's in Hollywood getting scripts and that sort of thing, essentially selling them to studios to get them work to work on big Hollywood movies.
Yeah, so
and but commercials and music videos and everything else, they do everything.
Yeah, it's effectively the management of this talent and knowing who the right people are for the right jobs and pitching them, and then once these jobs happen, you, by virtue of making the connection, become this producer. You become the person that can kind of make it all happen.
Exactly.
So it's a very interesting job, and it's something that I don't think people sort of shoot too straight when you see it. And so our hope is that, similar to last guest chat with Tom, you guys can get a sense of what these kind of jobs are.
Because
they're super interesting. Even if you're not in the film industry. If you are, then it's even more interesting.
Yeah.
And so I think let's just get into it.
Yeah.
So Stephen's gonna arrive in a moment, and we're going to have a chat. But after that, myself, Graham, and Gad will have a little catch-up to talk a little bit more about the wedding.
Cool.
Talk a little bit more about one or two of the things we've watched recently before we close up and go home. So if you guys are all cool with that,
have you got something that you
might be able to do to keep you busy while I chat to Stephen? Gaddy, do you want to just catch up on some rest?
Yeah, I'm going to have a nap.
Have a fat nap. Okay, cool.
I'm going to go work on our innovation and creativity so we can get gold next time.
Oh, that's the spirit. All right, great. Thanks, guys. This is Stephen Adams popping in to rent something. How's it?
I'm great. Doing great.
It's great to meet you. It's great to be introduced to you. And I get to know you for the next sort of 40 minutes.
All right, let's dive in.
When I started the podcast, I roped in a lot of my friends, a lot of the people around the Bioscope. But it's every now and again, I get to meet a new person, and you're a new person.
I am new. Well, new to this place.
Yeah. So how do you introduce yourself? We're at a cocktail party. What do you say?
My name is Stephen Adams, and I am from California. And, you know, if we're talking about film, I always dreamed of film since I was a child. I wanted to be in Hollywood. And, you know, when I was in elementary school, I made a short film. When I was in junior high school, I was a film festival judge for 3 years. And in high school, I had a cinematography class, and that's when I really went even further. I, you know, just fell in love with film, and we had a great teacher that introduced us to some incredible films.
There was a cinematography class in high school.
Yes.
That's special.
And this is going back some time now. So, you know.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Bay Area, you know, the San Francisco Bay Area.
Okay.
In Oakland specifically.
Yeah, because California is huge.
Yeah.
Okay. But San Francisco is a little bit away from Hollywood.
It is.
But it's close. It's close by.
Close but a different world. I mean, you know, Northern California is always, it's funny. Northern California has its relationship to the history of cinema. The earliest cinema studies that were done, motion picture studies, were done at Stanford University.
Okay.
Commissioned by Leland Stanford from a British man named Edward Muybridge. And the thinking that Stanford had was that he had some theory at the time that horses, when they were galloping at some point, had all four legs off the ground. But nobody could prove it at that point.
Okay.
And so he commissioned this man who was a photographer, this crazy British ne'er-do-well named Edward Muybridge, who had a very wild life, to do these studies at Stanford.
Okay.
And that is also a testament to how that university has always had a technological aspect from its very, very inception.
Okay.
And so these things led, these studies led to the advent of motion pictures.
Lovely. Even though, you know, it cropped up in France, in Europe, you know, the first form of cinema, but they were doing this in the States as well.
Yeah, no, I would argue that what we did in the States, I was there.
I know what you mean.
I was there in the late 19th century because, you know, I'm immortal. But
No, everyone, that's very exciting.
Yeah.
But what keeps you busy now? A bunch of things.
Yeah, so, you know, that was the beginning of my fascination with film. And then my father was like, "Are you kidding me?" He grew up in L.A. and he's like, "Are you kidding me? You're not doing that. You're not going to L.A. People in Hollywood are bad." And I'm like, "What?" He's like, "You're going to study something sensible, like, you know, business, and go into something like finance." So that's kind of what I did for a while. Yeah. I did banking and finance for a few years, international finance. And then somewhere in my late 20s, I was like, if I don't do this now, you know, I'm never going to do it.
You always had the itch.
Always.
To be in it.
Always.
Okay. So come late 20s, you then entered.
I just made the decision to quit. I literally quit my job as a young executive. And, you know, because I'd been doing banking through college. And even though I was studying international business, I did a separate French cinema.
Okay.
Minor.
Okay.
So I was like always studying these French films and, you know, living in that world. I kind of never fully gave into what my dad wanted me to do. But I will say this, you know, when I made the decision to leap into Hollywood, I wound up working at a talent agency, and it became very clear that everything I knew in banking and finance was absolutely applicable. It's a business.
It's amazing how, and we'll get into it, you are familiar with Denim. Denim Richards, who's also a fellow Californian.
Yeah, and we work together.
Is spending more and more time in Africa, and specifically Southern Africa. He raised the fantastic and important point that the film industry employs every single industry.
It does.
Where others don't. We do need bankers. We do need finance brains. Because otherwise, you know, the financing of this film could flop.
We are the only art form that requires multiple millions of dollars, rand, francs, euros, whatever the hell you're talking about, a pound, sterling. Mm. It's a lot of money. And I guess, you know, the thing that is clear to me is that there's definitely an information gap. I think people suffer from not knowing about money and not knowing about finance, but yet at the same time needing so much of it to do what they want to do.
Yeah.
And I have a very good friend who works in finance, and I don't know how much language I can use, but, you know, I've invited...
We can swear? If that's the question.
Oh, good. that's the question. I'm tippy-toeing around But, you know, he you know, I invited him to come speak to a group of interns at the Motion Picture Academy. And, you know, it's a very prestigious situation, and he's like... He asked them to turn the lights down. I was like, what is he doing? He's like, can you turn the lights down even more? So it was almost dark in the room. Okay. He said, now I have to deliver my message to all of you. And so we're all waiting to say, what is he going to say? Mm-hmm. And he leaned forward and said, fuck you and fuck your dreams.
Jesus.
And so everybody's like, what? The whole room went into an uproar. And even the people from the academy were like, what is going on? And they're looking at me. I'm like, I don't know. I didn't know he was going to say this. And then someone said, what did you say? He said, I said, fuck you and fuck your dreams. And
what was his intention behind that provocative statement?
We'll get there. Yeah. So, you know, the room was, you know, up in an uproar, as was I. I was like, what is happening here? These guys are never going to ask me back. And he said, now that I have your attention, and the girl said, I find that very offensive. I'm going to leave. He said, then good, you should. If that's all it takes for you to leave the industry you say you love, then you should go. And he said, now that I got your intention, what I mean is this. Your dream is your dream. Your dream is to make a film. My dream is to make money. Our goal here today is to make those two things come together in a way that makes sense to both of us.
Mm.
And that is the key, you know, that, you know, a filmmaker should be financially savvy. It does not detract from them as an artist, and frankly makes them more likely to be able to do what they want.
Yeah, and just understanding the point of it all. You know, like, obviously a big part of it is your expression and your vision and, you know, creating this beautiful piece of art, but it needs to exist in a world where others make money. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
I mean, I've got terrible examples of, you know, having done, you know, over the years, I used to do consulting with a film finance attorney, and we would bring in clients and help them package their films and develop their finance plans and things like this. And we met a guy who had an incredible script, and he, you know, was just out of university, and he said, you know, I want to make this film with my friends. And I was like, well, if you're gonna make it with your friends, you should make this for like a few hundred thousand dollars.
Yeah.
No, I need 2 million. I'm like, you're not gonna get 2 million from a distributor. We have a distributor who would like to work with you and bring in a cast that they think is meaningful because they love your script. I don't want to work with them. I'm like, okay.
Here's the compromise.
What are we supposed to do? So he's like, you guys don't know what you're talking about. I can do this. I'm like, well, we do know what we're talking about, but why don't we just agree to disagree and part ways?
Yeah, well, then go and Kevin Smith this thing, and let's see whether you do well. Yeah,
and then a few months later, he came back and said, I got my money. I got all of it. And I'm like, oh, I wonder where that came from. He goes, and I'm going to make the film, and I'm going to do it my way. I'm like, well, good. Good for you.
Yeah.
You convince somebody of this case, and let's see what happens. Well, you know, time went by, and what we realized is that he had gotten his mother to mortgage her house and give him her retirement.
Oh, Lord.
And make the movie with his friends, who were not really... didn't have the chops to be leads in this film.
Yeah.
It needed people with more experience. Mm. And they didn't have any name recognition, so the film sat and now has tied up his mother's feet. It's done nothing.
Yeah.
And the mother now lives in a one-bedroom apartment in her, you know, in her late life.
Yeah.
So, you know, there you have it.
But, I mean, this is also why they're producers.
Yes.
And there's directors, and they have... At a good level, they should have these vastly different jobs where the one can focus on a more creative expression and making sure the actor, you know, delivers and, you know, and then the producer is there to worry about that money, right? And
the producer's there to worry about everything.
And everything.
Everything.
And everything. There's a reason we've said this. There's a reason why the best film award, the biggest one of the night, at the Oscars, goes to the producers.
It does.
Because they literally do it all.
We're the only ones that hire our own bosses.
Interesting.
You know?
Okay.
I mean, because the director becomes the... I mean, even if you've optioned a book, labored to translate that into a screenplay that is viable, that screenplay has then attracted a cast and a director. At the end of the day, the director's telling you what to do most of the time.
Sure.
You know, so there... But you're there, and you're there to solve problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'm being slightly, you know, flippant about it, but because obviously the greatest are collaborations.
Sure.
And that, you know, all of this is creative. Creative problem solving is an art unto itself.
Yeah. What is the biggest... slice of your pie in terms of what you do, producing, because you also talent managing.
Yeah, I'm a manager producer. I would say, you know, most of my clients are people who produce, so we kind of form like a, it's sort of every day is divided between pursuing opportunities from other people in Hollywood and then pushing the project agenda forward as well.
Okay, because there's also a history of visual effects, hey?
Yeah, well, you know, I represented a company, so any company that has an agenda, you know, I can figure out what they want, and we execute it. And that company is a company called Buff. They're based in Paris. They're, I think, 42 years old now, the oldest one in France. And my job there was to represent them to the American studio system, and then when we got jobs, to executive produce them.
But, I mean, these are big jobs.
Yeah,
this
big jobs.
This was Avatar and stuff, right?
Yeah.
How does this all fit?
Well, the first thing I brought was Avatar, or part of Avatar, and half the effects on the first Thor. We did major sequences in Life of Pi, Dark Knight, Dark Shadows, Green Lantern, Green Hornet. You know, it was an incredible run.
So you got to know the company through your life and business in general, and then your job was to be the person on the ground in the States who could pitch them and give them work.
Yes, I mean, that consisted of not just pitching, but I mean, I'd read every bloody script that came out in Hollywood, anything that was in development that might remotely need effects. I had my hands all over it. And then, you know.
And did you know what your team in France, this company, was sort of specializing in or capable of? And you would know whether it was the right size for them or the right style. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, that company has an incredible... nimble effect. I mean, you'll know they invented the bullet effect that's in The Matrix, you know.
Oh, shit.
So, I mean, they made history with their work.
And the company, once again?
It's called Buff, B-U-F.
B-U-F.
Buff. Very, very French. It's for Buffin, the owner's nickname.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
they pioneered the bullet.
They pioneered the bullet. The camera mapping was actually done first by them for a Michel Gondry video, Like a Rolling Stone, for the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Gondry.
Yeah, Gondry's out of his mind. Yeah, out of his mind in the best way.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that was a hell of an adventure. I mean, we did Enter the Void.
Yeah. You know, outside the bioscope right here is a poster called I Entered the Void, and it's covered in signatures. I'll show it to you after our chat.
You've got to.
When Enter the Void was possible for the bioscope to screen, we realized just how balls crazy this movie was.
And so
we then made it a challenge to come and watch. It's like 3.5 hours or 3 hours. And it's an absolute mindfuck of a movie. And so if you made it to the end, we got a tequila company to sponsor a shot, and you got to sign your name. And I mean, we sold out.
It's an incredible achievement. I mean, the things that were done, the things that were created, you know, to fulfill that vision were extraordinary.
Okay, so were you in any parts involved at that time with the film?
Yeah, but I was, you know, I was with the company then. I mean, we were involved with everything. So,
okay,
yeah.
So at that time, can we talk specifically about some of the wild shots of that movie? Because they would have had to, someone would have had to animate these moments.
Oh, yeah, they're crazy. I mean, there's things that, you
know. So there's a scene, and I actually don't even necessarily want to give it away, but there's a scene in Into the Void that once you have seen it, you will never, ever forget it.
You can't unsee it.
And you were somehow involved in that.
Yeah, I mean, I saw many iterations of this work. I mean, that was not something that was under my direct purview, but I was absolutely.
You were sort of there when it was happening.
I was there for the evolution of the film and, you know, the creation of these effects and the insanity that, you know, was being asked to be delivered. I mean, you know what the vision is like.
Yeah, so just very, very short for those who don't know, Enter the Void is this crazy film made by, I don't know how you pronounce his name, Gaspar Noé.
Gaspar Noé is exactly right.
And the whole movie, it's brilliant. The whole movie is through the eyes of this main character who's an American, effectively a drug dealer living in Tokyo. But literally when he splashes his face, when he looks in the mirror, the whole movie is through his eyes.
Yes.
And sort of first act turning point, inciting incident, quite early on in the film, he gets shot.
Yes.
In a bathroom. And you then become his soul that leaves his body. And you wander through the streets of Tokyo and you go through drain pipes and you even enter into people's bodies and travel through people's bodies. So it's an absolute marvel in terms of visual effects. So it's very cool that Boof were involved in that, because there is a scene when he goes inside a woman's body.
Yes.
And this is the scene we're talking about, where there is a very large close-up of what it would look like to be inside the vagina during the sex scene. That's all I'm going to say.
I mean, you've said enough. And, you know, it's
okay, wild.
It's shocking to see it.
Okay. But, okay, so when you talk of talent management, you know, your initial thinking is a person, you know, a director or a actor or a writer, but it can be a company.
Oh, yeah, in many cases it's companies. I mean, I'm working with the refinery here in South Africa.
Yeah, because they can do stuff. And they can probably do stuff at an exchange rate that's favorable to an American company.
They can do it at a high level and at a great exchange rate, and we are spreading the good news about that now.
That's amazing. Yeah. Some of the other talent you've managed has been people like Spike Lee.
Well, Spike Lee is not someone I've managed, but I've worked, you know, he is... we've worked in various capacities over the last couple of decades. One of my actors is someone who has a long history of doing historically based solo shows. Okay. And we took one of those to New York, and Spike said he would like to direct the adaptation. And so he wound up directing the first piece of original content for Starz was that piece called A Huey P. Newton Story, and that was about the founder of the Black Panther Party. Mm. And we shot that in the early digital age of the, you know, early 20th century, 21st century, which, you know, seems so, you know.
Yeah, it's quite, it's a little while ago now.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, we shot it with 25 cameras and, you know, it was a sort of this digital tour de force. Mm. It was kind of, you know, the really pushing out of film into what digital could do. And, you know, you're far more nimble. You couldn't have done that with 25, you know, film cameras.
Yeah.
It was impossible.
So as a result of knowing this theater actor, that's how you then got introduced to Spike.
Yes, the actor's name is Roger Ginver Smith, and Roger has done more films with Spike than any other actor.
Yeah.
I think they've done 13 or 14 films together.
Okay.
Yeah. You'll know him. You'll know him from, for example, Do the Right Thing.
Yes.
The guy that goes, this is Malcolm.
Okay.
Smiley. Okay. He's Smiley. Yeah.
Lovely. Okay, you've represented him.
For a long time.
And that got you in with Spike.
That's how that happened. I mean, as these things do, the relationships just flow into another thing. And then a few years later, we wound up doing a piece called Rodney King. And that was something we did for Netflix. And with that piece, we wound up finding a sponsor who said, hey, you know, if you guys would like to promote this film at Cannes, you know, and you can bring Spike, then we'll give you X amount of dollars and we'll give you this, you know. So we brought Spike there, we did PR, we did a a big gala dinner. But what we did in the process is that it was the very early days of Netflix. We learned how to use the reach of the streamer, which is incredibly global. Mm. And so we're like, let's just translate this press release into multiple languages and push into places that, you know, might be difficult to reach in the past, but now everybody's sort of at your reach, no matter where you are. And I think that's something, you know, I always remind filmmakers, I mean, be ambitious with your outreach. Don't hold back. In the 21st century, you can get anywhere. You know, it's like, there's no such thing as local content if you're on a streamer.
Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, a mutual friend and the person who connected us, Mundler, it's amazing that you can make the South African story and it becomes a hit in all parts of the world.
That is great. I mean, Heart of the Hunter is a perfect example of that. It was the first African film to debut at number one globally on the Netflix platform. Yeah. That means it was number one in 78 countries.
Yeah.
That have no, I mean, they're all over the world, everywhere from Europe to Asia to Latin America. No rhyme or reason to why they responded, but they loved it. It was just a great story. Mm. And I think it's very heartening to see that.
Yeah.
You know, that I think that's one of the biggest effects of streaming is that it's kind of leveled this sort of presumptions that people live by, that people only want to see what they knew, when in fact it's been quite the opposite. They want to see things they don't know about.
No, the most successful stuff has been these Korean, Korean series and dramas. Yeah. It's incredible.
And you can't really predict it. I mean, Squid Games, who would have known?
Sure.
They didn't plan it to do what it did. It just did.
Yeah. They were just being their crazy selves.
Right.
Like,
right.
They had this wild idea, the sort of society of Korea would lend itself to this bizarre game. At these crazy stakes with these kinds of people, and then here comes this crazy, unique idea. It's lovely.
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, and then, you know, you look at Money Heist. I think Money Heist was one of the first shows that, I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I heard the name, haven't watched it.
Money Heist was a local language Spanish show that got picked up by Netflix, sat on their stream platform, and people just found it, and it became this international cult thing. And now it's got, you know, this rabid following.
Yeah.
And they wound up bringing it back for multiple seasons, and now there's a spinoff, and they've even done a Korean remake of it, of course.
Interesting.
Yeah,
interesting.
And an Indian remake. So,
interesting.
Yeah.
What is keeping you busy right now? Like, what is the biggest thing in your life at the moment?
Right now, it is this bridge building between the U.S. and Africa. Is a lot, you know, a lot. You mentioned Mondo Dubé. He keeps me very busy. And I work with several other filmmakers here. So it's very
Is this
exciting.
An exploratory mission? Is this you coming to meet more folks, understand more? What is this trip for you now?
Well, this trip is really about extending what's already happening. I mean, we've done a lot already. I mean, Mondo has a three-picture deal with Netflix Africa. I'm working with Tabang Balea, who has a film called Lobola Man, which is, you know, just debuted at number two in South Africa and number seven in the world. So again, it's like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's really crazy what can happen. And I've got a young actress named Wanda Banda who's on Blood and Water.
Yes.
And also was in Heart of the Hunter to, you know, connect all the dots. I work with another actor named Bonko Koza,
Bonko
was the lead.
He's been
Heart
on
Hunter.
He's been a visitor to the video store. So nice to.
So we need all these things for you. Everybody's connected, and as film tends to do, no matter what, it kind of connects people. There's always some kind of cluster of artists who work together.
And of course, we live in this age where you could Zoom and you could chat and you could feel connected. But what led to this actual physical trip? What was the impetus on that?
Well, I'm on the advisory board of the Durban Film Mart.
Okay, so you've come out for the festival.
Yeah, I've come out for that. This is the second or third time, and you know, I've been involved for a while.
Okay, and what is your hope to achieve?
Just this unification. I think that if you look at the African diaspora in the Americas, in the Caribbean, in Europe, who've been disconnected from the continent for centuries, it's a moment. That's an extraordinary moment to sort of reconnect all that and find commonalities and find a way forward. I think there's always been a discouragement for that to happen, and I think right now with this happening, it's kind of amazing.
What is the how does the discouragement show up?
Oh, I just think that there was a colonial benefit to separating people. You know? Sure. And I think that that's kind of being ended. I think that the, you know, unification is the way forward.
Yeah.
I think, frankly, for all human beings, I mean, I think that these sort of differences are always benefiting somebody.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, unity is benefiting everyone.
Yeah. And on the incoming cusp of American politics.
Oh, dear.
You know, you've got one group that is splitting people apart, and you've got another group that's desperately trying to keep people together. It feels that way, at least from my side.
Well, as someone who's outside of his own country, I should probably say no comment at the moment. Yeah. But let's just say that I believe in unity, and I think most humans want the same things.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I mean, unless they're up to something else.
Yeah.
But generally, you know, we all want the same thing. We don't. My success does not have to depend on your failure.
Yeah.
I mean, frankly, that is an antiquated, really tired notion, and we need to just dismiss that. I mean, yeah. This idea of scarcity and lack is kind of what's kept people motivated to be cutthroat.
Yeah.
And it's sad because, you know, we look at the idea of a film. Films succeed when everyone's unified.
Mm.
If there's backbiting and fighting going on in film, they tend to fall apart, yeah. You know, or they cost so much money to fix because it's a nightmare.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that there's something to be said for understanding where we are as a human race,
yeah.
And knowing what's best for us,
yeah.
Is to be kind and good.
Yeah.
And respectful.
So simple.
Things that mother would have told you as a child, but yeah. Hey. Here I am to remind you.
Yeah. Well, speaking of mothers and perhaps childhood, you said you grew up in Bay Area,
yeah.
San Francisco. I was lucky enough to go there once. I appreciated the fact that the weather kind of remains the same, right?
Well, you know, San Francisco itself has like got microclimates all over the city.
But it's a lovely city. And there's a few cities in America that stick out as being quite unique.
Yeah.
San Francisco is one of them. A lot of the American cities just look the same.
Like right.
Houston looks like, you know, a Portland or certain Portlands. But San Francisco's got such a unique character. I'm curious to know whether there was a film that you encountered growing up that was like your first love.
Well, going back to the Bay Area and going back to that cinematography class.
Which you're so lucky to have had in high school.
I am so lucky.
We, South African... as part of English, you get a film study, and we get the film that you just get the impression they haven't changed for many years because the tests are written for it. Do you know what I mean? Like the paperwork's done. No one's got the imagination to change it. So we watch these old movies that seem very outdated now. But that's the extent of film for us.
I mean, those are old movies, and I resisted. I was like, why did I sign up for this class? I thought it was going to be fun, and now we have to watch all these old movies, and they're black and white. I mean, that was my attitude.
Sure. No, but just the fact that you had a more practical course in high school is exciting.
It was incredible, though. But the instructor took us in, and we got to see this on a big screen projected on film, which is... also kind of amazing. But the first thing that we saw was Citizen Kane.
Okay.
And honestly, that film is so emblazoned on my mind that I can almost recollect it, you know, visually, sure. Just from beginning to end, as long as it is. And, you know, within a few minutes, we were all kind of like, you could feel the collective shift, like these kids were like, what are we seeing? And how amazing is this?
Yeah.
And, you know, I realize the film now is almost... probably about 80 years old, I guess.
Yeah.
But it still stands out as this incredible achievement of cinema.
Yeah, they pioneered a bunch of techniques that made it landmark at the time. I mean, just the ability to start from the one character in the room and get the person outside playing with the dog or whatever in frame, you know, certain things that we kind of take for granted now, but they had this incredible lighting system that they rigged, and they, you know, they were shooting a lot of films in studios, as we know, so they could control lighting, but in this case they dug deep trenches so that these big cameras could give you an angle that you'd never seen before. And so there was all this pioneering stuff that makes Citizen Kane one of the greatest films ever made.
I think so, and it's the mind boggles when you think back to what the kind of equipment was that they were dealing with back then.
Big, chunky, huge
giant,
cameras,
heavy, giant cameras and lighting.
Yeah.
And, you know, I listened to an interview by Orson Welles talking about that film, and someone said, you know, what made you think you could do this? He said, because I didn't know any better.
Yeah.
I didn't know what the limitations were, so I didn't consider them.
Yeah.
And I thought that's kind of the best thing I'd ever heard. I was like, wow, just don't worry about it. Just figure it out. Make something happen.
Yeah. It's reminding me, this is a little bit of a more business finance-y sort of tangent, but Simon Sinek, he's a speaker and he's a consultant and he does these great talks. He's an incredible speaker. Raises something similar about your own company, and it's about not knowing your limitations, not knowing your competitors, just being you. Mm. And there's something that amazing that comes from that, where you're not comparing yourself to others. You're blazing your own trail. Others will compare themselves to you.
Well, listen, a copycat cannot set a trend.
Yeah.
And trends are set by people who are bold and individual.
Yeah.
So, I mean, whether that's something visual, whether that's in fashion, style, music, whatever, you break the mold and that's the one that makes you who you are.
Yeah. You know? No, and his example was, you know, Apple isn't comparing themselves to other companies. They're designing and making their own stuff.
Yeah.
They don't have competitors.
And I think that's another thing that a lot of us forget, that we are only competing against our own potential.
You know, that's lovely.
You know, if you're watching what somebody else is doing, you're really not doing anything except, you know, wasting your time, really.
Yeah. Over more into studies, early career, did you study after school?
No, I mean, after that, I was, you know, when I got into Hollywood, it was one of those things where I just sort of networked my way, and I met a girl at a party, and she said, I work in a casting office, and when you come to Los Angeles, call me, because casting directors know a lot of people.
Mm.
And so I was like, cool. So I called her. She goes, yeah, there's a job at this agency, and I've told them about you. You know, give them a call.
Mm.
And so I called them, and I went in for an interview, and they hired me. And so I wound up working with an agent, you know, on an agent's desk, you know, 3 weeks after being in L.A. So I really kind of had this illusion that, oh, well, that's what happens. You just get a job, and you just jump into Hollywood, and it just happens. I didn't know that those jobs are very coveted.
Okay.
And,
so how lucky that happened.
I was very lucky. And then the other, the head assistant found out, you know, somehow. She was like, well, how'd you get this job? And who's your dad? I mean, what movies has he made? I'm like, my father's not in this industry. She's like, oh, okay. And then they started the hazing.
Okay.
And
they're like, okay, he's a newbie. Yeah.
He's a newbie and he's not some nepotistic kid, so we can torture him. And they did.
Okay.
They tried very hard to make me quit.
And what were you doing? What was that first job?
I was assisting an agent.
Okay.
Yeah.
What agent specifically? What kind of agent?
A talent agent.
Okay. So this is, they had people under their books. They were sending them out for auditions.
Yeah.
Okay. And they were trying to match them with projects.
Exactly.
Trying to get them work.
And it's a you know, it's a machine. You have to know everything about everything to be efficient. Mm. And so that's a lot of work. And, you know, I always loved reading scripts and analyzing scripts. And so I had an easy time with it. But, you know, as with anything, as we keep coming back to this theme of people and thinking that others are their competitors, when in fact, you know, nobody really rewards you for destroying your competition. They reward you for being good at your job.
Mm.
And, you know, these guys were doing everything to try to make me quit. I kind of fell into it. I mean, it's laughable now, but at the time they were like doing things like, oh, you know, somebody quits. They're like, oh, well, Steve's so great. Why don't we just put him on two agents' desks? I'm like, well, great. You're going to double my work. Do I get a raise? Well, no. I mean, it's, you know, it's so easy for you. And then when the receptionist quit, the decision was made, well, you will work as the receptionist and you will cover two agents. And I think I'm going backwards here. So I remember calling my father saying, these people are humiliating me and I can't believe this and I'm going backwards. And I've made a mistake and I never should have done this. I've gone from being an executive to being an assistant.
Yeah.
And now I'm a receptionist.
Yes.
And he said, well, you know, a couple of things on that. You know, you're telling me that you are feeling humiliated. He said, well, the last time I checked, that was a choice.
Yeah.
So you're choosing to be humiliated, and I'm embarrassed for you.
Interesting.
And he said, also, you kept saying that you want to meet. You keep saying that you want to meet lots of people in Hollywood, and now you are answering the phone at a very big agency, and everybody that they know goes through you first. But you're too egocentric to realize that it's an opportunity. They're trying to hurt you, and you're letting them hurt you, but you're getting what you want, and you can't see it.
Yeah, interesting.
And I was like, God damn it, he's right. I was so angry. And it took me, I was like even angrier then. I was like, ah, you don't know what you're talking about. He goes, call me when you get your mind together. He hung up in my face. And
way to go, Dad.
Yeah, he was like, shut up. Yeah. You know, so I took a few days that weekend, and I was like, ugh. But, you know, by Monday, I'd kind of really realized, I'm like, every single person in this town that calls this company goes through me. Okay. What's the opportunity?
You get to be their first impression.
I get to be their first impression. It's the rest is up to me. So I decided to be as helpful and as amazing as I could possibly be, and it made the days fly by. And soon I knew about everything, and people started to develop friendships with people and relationships. And
then you became invaluable to the company,
yeah,
I'm sure.
Yeah. And then I went on vacation and came back. And every single day that I was gone, they were calling, where's this, where's that? I'm like, oh, yeah, don't worry about it. I was very helpful. And when I got back to work, they'd hired some new people. Mm. But the new people were dependent upon me, so it didn't matter. I was like, oh, I don't mind. You know, I just didn't mind. And I wound up through that meeting and a manager who represented people like Lawrence Fishburne, Eric Stoltz, Blair Underwood, and David Caruso, and said, would you come and work with me? And I've watched you, you know, doing what you do, and I'm very impressed, and I'd like you to come here. So I wound up leaving and becoming a manager, and that's how that happened. Mm. And then that opened up a whole other world of adventure. So,
yeah. So who have been some of the most rewarding people to work with, just off the top of your head?
I mean, gosh.
Who are some of those people that I think you would have a more, you know, maybe the world knows them, but you've gotten to know them on a more personal level?
Well, I think number one would be Spike Lee. I think he's incredible. I think the man is a genius on so many levels.
Yeah.
You know, I look back in his career and I realize that he was someone who was always working on, you know, for example, gender parity. In the 80s, he had women doing things that nobody else was doing and was not making anything about it. He just opened up doors. Mm. He'd always had, you know, diversity in his crews and launched many, many, many careers. I mean, there's so many people that can trace their roots back to him. So I think he's been incredibly influential and remains so.
Mm.
And just the things that I've learned from him about just, you know, the idea that anyone who's on a set is making a film. And so everyone's ideas are meaningful and that you should have them. And you should, not that you should be imposing them, but if there's a crisis, come up with a solution.
Yeah, work together on this. Don't just put your hands up.
Work together on it. You know, James Cameron made an incredible impression on me with Avatar. I mean, the man, his vision, the where he was seeing things and how long it took us to catch up to where he was, I was like, oh my God, this man lives on his own planet. He is so brilliant. Okay. And, you know, we forget how much of an impact he's had on visual effects and you know, keeps moving them forward.
Yeah.
He's amazing and tells stories in the middle of all that.
Yeah.
So, you know,
some of those things that you had to catch up on in terms of how he realized certain things or like an artistic vision? Or?
You know, for example, if you're sitting in a room, because he sits with an IMAX size screen and you analyze visual effects. And so whatever suite of things we're working on, he was talking about them and this and that needs to be changed. And I'm looking, I'm like, what's wrong with that? Then suddenly I'm like, oh, I see what he's talking about. But it would take a while for everybody to catch up to what he was seeing and what he wanted. Mm. Yeah, that, you know, that just surpassing kind of vision and pursuit of excellence that, you know, it makes his films what they are.
Lovely, man. So we do have these four great loves that we speak of, which are the films that you've loved across your life. But I think we're skipping a few, which is totally fine. What are some of the all-time favorites? Let's maybe get to that.
Well, we already talked about Citizen Kane, which was when my mind really opened to what was possible.
And that came to you in about high school. Hey,
when it came to you in high school.
Yeah, so it's your high school crush, you can totally marry your high school crush.
I mean, you know, it's possible that you could have a crush and marry them or have an affair because there's too many.
No, they are. But I mean, just it's always nice just to chat movies.
Oh, my God. I mean, you know, I think, because I think about that suite of films that we saw. I mean, because that was, we started with Citizen Kane, then we went to Rebel Without a Cause, which was also kind of like drove us insane.
Cool.
Kane Mutiny, The Learning Tree by Gordon Parks. Gordon Parks is someone who was an incredible photographer, African American, who only made a few films. You'll know Shaft.
Sure.
But The Learning Tree is incredible.
The Learning Tree.
The Learning Tree, yeah.
Okay.
So all that whole, I still remember the whole curriculum like it was yesterday.
Yeah.
And what else did we see? The Kane Mutiny, that was amazing. But that whole cluster of films is
what sort of left the biggest impression.
It left the biggest impression. But then, you know, beyond that, I would say that, you know, a film like Malcolm X is for me incredible. I just saw a restored 35 millimeter print of that in London, and I was like, wow.
Mm.
Just the level of achievement that that Spike reached back then, because that was 89 or 90, I think.
Yeah.
I was just blown away.
That was Denzel Washington.
Yeah, Washington. Incredible performance.
Malcolm X.
Incredible arc, incredible writing, incredible filmmaking. It's just stands out for me, you know, as a film that just really, in its time, should have gotten far more accolades than it did.
I looked at this the other day. In the best director category of the Oscars, we're almost approaching 100 years.
Right.
So you got like a pie chart of 100. There hasn't been a black director.
No, not yet.
That's ever won.
No.
Spike Lee's won Oscars, but it's been for his screenplays.
And that was for the screenplay.
Yeah. There's been two women. One of which was an Asian woman, but there hasn't been a black director.
No.
That's one.
I mean, it's
interesting.
It's listen, the Academy still has a long way to go.
No, sure.
The industry has a long way to go.
It's fascinating to me that it, you know, and there was that one year, if you remember, where Halle Berry won for Monsters Ball.
Right.
Denzel Washington won for Training Day, and everyone was like, all right.
Right.
We're into a new era. And then it didn't, nothing happened for
change.
Years. Nothing changed.
Yeah. And it's funny, it's funny because I was going to mention this, my father, when he was growing up in L.A., his mother worked for Hattie McDaniel, who was the first Oscar winner, the first black Oscar winner for her role as Mammy in Gone with the Wind.
Okay.
And he resented the era because, you know, his parents were very, I guess they enjoyed Hollywood a little too much, and they wound up divorcing. And he and his brother were sent away to live with their grandparents. So that's one of the reasons he didn't want me to go to Hollywood.
Okay.
But we've always had this weird connection to that industry since his day.
Yeah, and I just love it. You know, there are these lights that just draw people around the world to sort of be a part of.
Yeah.
But it's not always, and this is the most important thing for so many people to know, it's not always about just being the director or the star. There are so many other important, integral, shifting roles behind the scenes. And I saw that. So I was in film school and realized, what's the point of all of us making these movies if there's no place to show it?
Yeah.
Joburg needs its independent cinema space. And so me and my friend Daryl, we started it 14 years ago.
And it's amazing.
And for you, someone's got to manage these artists, these companies, these visionaries, because good management will get them those jobs.
Yeah, I mean, and we've got to imagine new opportunities for things. I mean, everything's changing all the time. And where are the audiences now? Theatrical audiences need to be nurtured and cared for, I think, the way that you are. I mean, you are doing something very specific. I think theater chains around the world have sort of have a lag in the way they care for their audiences, considering how much they're asking them to pay.
Yeah.
You know, they need to give a lot more than they do. And I think we need to kind of go back to the old-fashioned, you know, the studios, back in the olden days, knew how to do it. They would put people on trains, and you would get out, and you'd cross the whole of America and the world and promote a film. And you would get off and dazzle them and make them come to the theater. And honestly, that would still work because you know, the only difference between being at home and being out of the house these days is the experience.
Yeah.
So let's give it to them. Let's give them something. No.
And that's been the focus of the Bioscope is, you know, can we eat something at the same time?
Or right.
Have we changed the flavors of our slush puppy to match the movie? I'm busy planning
these
that
things
now.
Matter.
Yeah, we got
they matter.
We got Deadpool and Wolverine coming up, and I want to do that just because it's a, you know, this fun, silly movie. And I'm changing the flavors to match the colors, you know,
nice.
Which this is a film that very clearly is red and yellow. So it's these fun things. And we're planning an eat-along for a Studio Ghibli film that we're releasing, old classic, My Neighbor Totoro. And we're going to serve food at certain times. And
I love
it. We got people to dress up in tennis clothes to watch challenges.
This is the best.
I love it.
This is the best.
No, we have lots of fun. But yeah, you're right. It's all about the experience.
It's all about the experience.
But yeah.
So another film that I love is The Matrix.
Yes. Okay.
Because of the convergence of story and technology, that film stand out for me. I mean, I went to, in LA, we do, speaking of experiences, there's screenings in the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. So, okay. Yeah. And so it's a great
what
place.
What is the Hollywood Forever Cemetery?
The Hollywood Forever Cemetery is where a lot of, you know, old time actors are buried. It's a beautiful cemetery.
Okay.
It looks like a park. There are monuments to all sorts of people. I mean, rock and roll. I mean, there's just like a history of entertainment, you know, 'cause as we know, all good things must come to an end. A lot of them wind up in there.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a crazy thing to go see a movie in this graveyard.
Yeah.
And you know, especially horror films.
Yeah, I'd imagine. Yeah.
But The Matrix in there, it was pretty good.
Yeah.
And it was also a day where it was kind of misty and raining a little bit. And
which is uncommon for LA.
It was uncommon, but it was perfect. And, the film just held up so well. It was just like, oh my God, I love this thing.
Did you do this recently?
A couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
LA's quite a city. It's got a very similar geography to Joburg.
Yes.
In that it's just
sprawling.
Sprawling. And you go over the hill and do it again. You go over the hill and do it again. But I feel like we've got the pace and the intensity of New York.
Right.
As Joburg.
This place is a lot.
Yeah, where LA is a little bit like Cape Town. I think it's clicky. I think it's a bit more whimsical, a bit more hippie, a bit more.
It can be.
Where Joburg is like New York. It's that Dustin Hoffman, I'm walking here. We put our head down and we do
things. It depends on where you
are. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, old Hollywood itself is pretty rough.
Yeah.
And, you know, downtown LA is, you know, has its challenges. I mean, it.
Well, listen, that's another way in which LA is very similar to Joburg.
Yeah.
Downtown LA is very similar to our downtown Joburg,
right.
Which is little ghosts of a former glory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, still some level of industry down there, but it's not the new city. Our new city is Santon, which is similar to sort of LA's Rodeo Drive.
Or West Side.
More sort of fancier glass buildings. Right. But we've got that downtown.
Right.
And your Skid Row is very similar to what we've got, you know, in our parts of downtown Joburg where guys are living in tents.
Yes. You know, the downtown Skid Row inspired one of my other favorite films, which is Blade Runner.
Okay. That's true, yeah.
Oh, my God. I still love that film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. And it's 2019. Hey.
Yeah.
That's when it's meant to be
right.
Set.
I know. Who knew? We have everything except the flying cars.
Yeah.
People are chipped. It's all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing. What's on the cards for the rest of your trip, just to wrap things up?
Well, you know, not much more. I mean, I've got some, you know, more meetings, more creative visualization, and figuring out what the next iteration of my future and my shared future is going to be with the other artists I'm working with. And, you know, you'll see, you know, we've got a few things up our sleeves.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
Are you your own boss at this point? Are you with a bigger agency?
I'm my own boss.
Structure?
Yeah, I'm my own boss.
Okay.
And we have a small company. We have just a group of five people. We have management, production, you know, it's management, development, production, and marketing. And we've marketed probably about 41 titles for Netflix. We do marketing for Spike Lee and lots of other studios. And we also run a film festival called Holly Shorts.
Okay, what's that?
Holly Shorts is a shorts film festival, as in the name, but we're Oscar qualifying in four categories, and we have had every year between 5 to 9 nominees and many, many winners for the last 7 or 8 years. So the festival's really become very prestigious. We're in the top 20 short film festivals in the world now.
So that, and you guys started it? You started
My colleague started it, and I got on board about 8 years ago.
Okay.
And then I kind of came in and internationalized it, and you know, I'm the guy who's like, let's do it. Let's celebrate it at Cannes. We're doing Holly Shorts London in December. Let's bring in the consulates to celebrate the fact that we have 43, you know, British films. We do things like that. So,
yeah.
You know, I'm trying to get more films from this continent all around, because I think there's so many, you know, from Cairo to, you know, Johannesburg. There's a lot of variety.
Yeah, yeah.
Lots of different cultures.
Lots
so,
of languages.
Lots yeah. of languages, lots of cultures. So I would really like to see more of that in the festival, too.
When you say it's Oscar qualifying, what does that mean?
That means that films that are in the festival, if they win certain categories, are automatically qualified for the Oscars.
Qualified to be submitted?
Qualified automatically in their category, like fiction, animation, documentary.
To be a shortlist or to be a nominee?
To be a nominee. I mean, to be shortlisted, yes. They can be, yeah. Yeah,
because we every year the Bioscope screens the Oscar-nominated short films.
Right. Well, then you've probably seen some of the ones that have come through our festival.
That's lovely.
Yeah, yeah. So we're already connected. You see, I told you. Yeah. Film connects everybody, one way or another.
Well, maybe Hollywood Shorts can, you know, once you finished your runs or at the end of your runs, you can come to Joburg. You can do.
We could do Hollywood Shorts South Africa.
Let's talk about it.
We could. Let's talk about it.
Thank you, man. Listen, all right. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. It's always lovely to just get some insights to life.
Yeah.
And how it all works and all the different folks working behind the scenes on film. So thank you for that. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. My pleasure. It's been fun.
And hope to see more of you every time that you come to Joburg.
Let's get this Holly Shorts Johannesburg thing going.
Lovely.
All right.
Sounds good.
Talk to you later.
Cheers. All right. Lekker chat.
Yeah.
It's always cool hearing that American accent.
Yeah.
it always feels so legitimate.
Yes.
The Bioscope, for the longest time, just had people saying they were going to come, and we just hoped that they would arrive.
Yes.
In the early days, before we had a ticketing system. And then one day I got a call from an American guy, and he's actually a dude I'd love to have on the show.
Yeah.
His name's Michael Canfield. Okay. Fascinating fucking man.
The drummer guy.
Yeah. Exactly. So Gad knows him through the music industry, because he was this musician. He's a drummer.
Right.
He had this ticketing company called Tixor, Michael Canfield. And the way he spoke, I was like, oh, this guy's legitimate. And we've used Tixor ever since.
Okay.
He was the guy that kind of brought it to South Africa.
Right.
He then realized he's still very much a musician and wants to kind of, in his sort of older chapter in his life, just focus on music. Mm. So he got it set up, and then he sort of sold it on.
Cool.
But fascinating dude. He was a session musician in New York.
Right.
At a time when him or where he was being used for a lot of songs.
Right.
And so he claims, and I need to double check this, but he claims he's playing the drums on Bee Gees' Staying Alive.
What?
And like a bunch of other songs. That's like someone had to do it.
Yeah.
And then he explains why he sort of ended up in Africa.
Right.
And I think perhaps a chat will best explain sort of how it sort of all led to.
He's currently in some small town.
Yeah, so he's got a house in Tilbach.
Right. Yes.
Which also sounded amazing in his American accent. Tilbach. But a fascinating dude. He's got these stories of like, you know, going on benders with Keith Richards and like... I don't want to say anything a bit out of turn.
But he's super talented. Like, I've watched him at shows where he's like singing and playing drums.
Yeah, he's
like
a sort of multi-instrumentalist.
Right.
Gaddy, you had a good time, hey, on the weekend?
Oh, just fantastic.
Well, it was like, lovely. Yeah. It was very hot. We were 3 hours north of Joburg.
Right.
Just outside of Bella Bella.
Okay.
And so we had this lovely, you know, the bush has always meant a lot to myself and Liz. We met first when we were little kids. Our dads did business together, and they her dad had their company had a sort of a bush lodge,
right?
And it was part of the culture to sort of invite your family on these weekends away to kind of entertain customers.
Okay.
So our sort of founding memories are us going on these bush trips,
right?
And once being connected again, there's just been a whole bunch of bush trips because her family like does those, and even mine do that. And so we just found it. We thought that it was the best way to do a wedding was do this kind of destination, but nothing too wild, just a few hours.
Yeah.
And treat all our friends to this night in a bush lodge.
Yeah.
And it was special. It was great. It was fucking hot. And I chose to be in a suit. I don't know why. I should have dressed up like a sort of Bedouin. You know what I mean? Like flowy robes, something to, yeah. You know. There's a reason why those dudes wear that in the Sahara, you know?
Oh, totally. Ooh.
You need the air to flow under your legs.
Should have a nice khaki safari suit.
I could have worn some khaki, but yeah. No, I was wearing a gray suit with a white shirt and a tie. But no, it was gorgeous and it was amazing and we all ate like kings and it was lovely.
We saw giraffe and zebra.
We saw giraffe and zebra as we came out going to the ceremony site, including some cheetah.
Nice.
So it was so cool to like treat the guests to that and everyone had a great time and it was lovely.
Awesome.
And it was just such a nice little highlight to get the podcast awards.
Yes.
On the night as well.
Right.
You know, it was such a nice little cherry on top of that cake. I watched, we didn't watch a lot this last week because of the wedding.
Yeah.
I got around to 90% of the Martha Stewart documentary. Okay. We eventually gave up because we were just too tired last night. But we were enjoying it. We brought it up as a Hey Did You Guys See? This is a documentary called Martha on Netflix. And I think it's great. And I think people should really look at it quite carefully and quite methodically to see how you can best make a documentary about a character.
Okay.
Especially a character that's quite guarded.
Yes.
And has had her whole life be about perfection and perfectionism, which is largely why she was so criticized, especially when... And this is certainly not a spoiler, but the big story of Martha Stewart was that at the height of her career, she was charged by the FBI.
Yeah.
It was originally about insider trading, but then it wasn't actually literally about insider trading, but it was more about how she lied to the FBI in that inquisition about insider trading.
Okay.
So it was like she didn't directly get it and do it, but she sort of kind of knew but lied about how much she knew. And just the lying of it became the charge. But we had to sort of stop, pause, rewind, and go, wait, now what is she saying?
Yes.
What's her statement? What did happen? So it's lovely to see.
Yes.
And it's very difficult as a filmmaker or as a documentary to craft this nuance.
Mm.
You know, it's one thing to make a whole meal about a crime.
Yes.
But when the crime is so subtle
and
so nuanced, you have to very carefully piece that whole thing together.
Mm.
And also what she says is very calculated and thought through as the character. You know, they got her, you can clearly see over the course of maybe one, possibly 2 days, if she was obviously wearing the same clothes, they shot her interviews, her main interviews, which, you know, goes throughout the whole thing. But she's still very done up, perfect, precise answers. And it's amazing to see what isn't mentioned.
Right.
You know, and what she doesn't say and how the camera stays on her in those moments where...
Is it one movie or a series?
It's a documentary. It's a single documentary.
Okay.
So yeah, Martha, which is on Netflix.
Mm.
I'll check that out.
Yeah, it's definitely worth it just to see how you craft this kind of personal, nuanced character documentary.
Okay.
You guys watching anything else?
Well, speaking of documentaries... I watched, I think it's called Zef, Die Antwoord. So I saw a trailer for this a while ago, and it's on their website. I think it's streaming somewhere else.
Their website?
Yeah, you just go to Die Antwoord.
Well, then this is interesting. It's like whether a documentary is made by the person or made about the person.
Yes.
And they can be completely different documentaries.
So this is very much made by Die Antwoord.
Okay.
Yeah. So I know Die Antwoord like really, really well. I'm... I wouldn't say I'm a fan of their music, but I was a fan of his previous band, Max Normal.
Sure. Which is, to
me, like, that Max Normal album is one of the best things that's come out of this country.
Yeah, Songs for the Mall.
Songs from the Mall, yeah.
From the Mall.
Yeah.
I think I could still recite, like, You Talk Too Loud in the Movies. Would you please be a little bit considerate?
So
I know the whole song.
Yeah, I put it in recently. CD playing Jesus Con, like, I know everything. There was Max Normal, and then Yolandi got involved, and then there was Max Normal TV. And I was literally at the show at Carfax.
With the PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is cool. Hey.
So they did a Max Normal. It was the last Max Normal TV show. They left the stage, and then Die Antwoord came on and did like a few songs, and everyone was like, what is this?
Oh, I missed that.
So they did a few shows at Carfax, but this was the last Max Normal TV show.
Okay.
I didn't know what it meant because it was still many years after that until like Die Antwoord actually came out.
I find it amazing that Die Antwoord did as well as they did worldwide.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? I get the South African joke.
Yeah.
You know, and I get how as South Africans, it's like we got that. But it's like it was a combination of a few things. And I think there was a culture of Zefness existing around the world. And
I know they blew up because Boing Boing, which was a very prominent blog, posted Enter the Ninja.
And that's a great start.
Mm.
And that's a huge start. That's like a step up that any band would dream of.
Yeah.
But then could have been forgotten the next day.
Yeah.
You know, something stuck. Something was that like sort of gooey stickiness that kept them so relevant or interesting.
Yeah.
So they've been quite a controversial band.
Yes.
In terms of there was an incident with an artist from, I think, Australia or New Zealand called Johnny, and then another case with this band Hercules and Love Affair. It was all, there's like a documentary series about the terrible things they've done, and they've never really answered to them.
Okay, so is this their statement, so to speak?
They don't mention any of the bad stuff.
Okay.
In this documentary, it's basically like a puff piece.
Right.
Okay. They don't mention the Max Normal whatsoever.
No, sure, because that's not them. It's like the world only started when they became Die Antwoord.
And like half of there's some stuff in the documentary, half of it's just bits of their music video, which is very frustrating. It's very padded out.
All right, so perhaps they missed an opportunity to give more of a formal statement on stuff.
It's like I think a lot of people would think that what they were saying is true. They wouldn't have any reason to believe otherwise. But knowing how much I know about them, I just got to a point where I'm like, I just can't handle these lies anymore. It's just ridiculous.
Because I remember once thinking of that main dude, Ninja, who's called Watkin.
Watkin Tudor Jones.
Watkin Tudor Jones, which is the coolest real name in real life. And I remember saying to someone like, he's like the sort of Sacha Baron Cohen of music. He's been these alter egos and he's created these characters. But it's interesting that he's sort of never gone back or been himself or kind of explained that he's playing characters. It's like he now just like lives this life and completely obliterates the memory of the previous ones, which is a pity because, as we said, the Max Normal stuff is very cool and totally worth celebrating. Like, you could go back and be a Max Normal today. And everyone would totally get it.
There's a whole album.
Like Sacha Baron Cohen can go back and do a Ali G movie again now if he wanted to.
Exactly.
It's interesting.
There's a whole Max Normal album that they recorded that was never released.
Interesting. Yeah. No, it was a very cool thing. He sort of dressed up like a schoolboy.
Yes.
Sort of wore this like schoolboy outfit, which was very cool.
Well, they were like office workers when it was the band as well.
Yeah, it was a combination. Maybe in my head I saw it as schoolboy, but they were wearing like ties. So it was like almost like workaholics.
Mm.
You know, like the sort of slacker dude.
I saw them as a four-piece once at the Rand show.
Okay.
That was so great.
Yeah, it's special, man. And they cuck actors.
Yes.
Like there was their time to sort of Chappie. Act in Chappie.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, they're the worst thing about this movie.
Yeah.
You got Hugh Jackman, you got everything, and it's like, fuck, they bad.
Yeah, see.
Just, oh, Jesus.
That was a choice.
It was a choice, and it was a bad one.
Yeah.
Lekker, guys. Yeah. Appreciate you coming in.
Mm.
Thank you for doing this shift.
Yep.
I'm off.
Yeah.
I'm off on my adventure. So, as we said, it wasn't going to be too many episodes this week. That's why you didn't get one on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
But now this is coming out on Thursday. This is Thursday now. We've got all our timelines all out of whack. But we wanted to give you this guest chat just to check in, give you a bit more of this kind of film industry discussion, which we think is so interesting. And then we'll be back next week.
Yeah.
I still don't think there's going to be a Tuesday episode because I'm still going to be away.
Yeah.
But we'll get back to the regular programming soon enough.
Cool.
We need to do the long-awaited Star Wars chat.
Oh, my Lord.
When's callback?
I don't know.
We should find a good time for it. Maybe there should be, you know...
I think we should like pre-record some episodes for December.
Well, because the new show's starting in a month, exactly a month.
Which
Skeleton Crew.
Skeleton Crew. It actually looks really cool.
It's like Goonies meets Star Wars.
Okay, cool.
It looks like a lot of fun.
Magic.
Yeah.
All right, we'll figure all that kind of stuff out.
We will.
And I'll have lots of movies I've watched on the plane.
Yes.
So I'll have lots to talk about. All right, guys. Thanks. Our home base is thevideostore.co.za. There are links to other episodes of other guests. We're trying our best to put them in different categories. We need to populate more of them to make that a bit easier. But you can always just scroll back in your feed and listen to those if you've missed them. But as I said, this is a little bit of a film industry series, and we got one or two others which will come down the line. But thank you guys.
Thank you.
Cool, Rusky.
And Gaddy, thanks for coming to my wedding.
Yeah, have an amazing honeymoon.
Thanks so much, guys. Yes. All right. We'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.